The second oration of St. Gregory Nazianzen is a classic in the annals of spiritual guidance and spiritual direction. It serves as the basis for many texts, several of which we are considering in this course, and one of which we'll consider shortly, particularly John Chrysostom's treatise on the priesthood and Gregory the Great's treatise on pastoral care. In it, Gregory Nazianzen is offering an explanation and an apology for his having effectively run away from his father's diocese after having been ordained by his father, the bishop, Gregory Nazianzen the Elder, for the purpose of assisting in the diocese. Gregory suddenly realized what it would mean to be involved in pastoral ministry, that it would mean forsaking his great love of solitude, of study, of combing and searching the scriptures, and it was just too much for him. So effectively, he ran away to Pontus to his friend St. Basil, and the two of them spent a considerable time reflecting on the effects and benefits of solitude. But eventually, he, as it were, repented of this decision and came back partly laden with the fruits of this time, but also with the need to explain to the people where he had gone on an occasion when he was actually supposed to be preaching his first homily to them. So this oration is partly an apology for having left that diocese, and also partly an explanation of what he now conceives the role of pastor or shepherd of souls to be. This is truly a clerical example of spiritual guidance, but it becomes a model for everyone involved in the task of spiritual guidance. Remember that he's just been formed and shaped by an experience in solitude with his friend, the layman at that point, St. Basil, who will eventually, parenthetically, be responsible for Gregory's own ordination to the episcopate. But Gregory has been nourished in a tradition that is not clerical, and yet now he is returning to clerical responsibilities and talking about what in his estimation, what in his vision it means to take on responsibility for guiding souls, for being someone who stands in the position of trying to speak to the specific spiritual needs of others. And this oration, the principles he articulates, particularly the need to be sensitive to differences within different people, to recognize that the same spiritual remedy may work for one person and may be poisonous for another, this perception, this delicacy, this sensitivity becomes something that is communicated, taken seriously, and applied and restated by many others throughout the centuries, most notably, as I mentioned, by St. Gregory the Great in his pastoral rule. So let's take a look at this classic text, and we'll only be able to look at certain highlights from it, but I'd strongly recommend coming back and spending some time reflecting on it to appreciate some of the real wisdom and delicacy of the author, who is now taking seriously his own pastoral charge, but who is also a master of the art of oratory and of a kind of an oratorical writing style. One might also need to recall that he himself went back and edited all of his orations before they were put into final form. So this reflects not only what he actually said to the people of Nazianzen on his return, but also reflects his own later capacity to nuance this in light of a much more extensive experience as a pastoral leader. If we look at the first couple of paragraphs, we're not going to note too much, except that he acknowledges that his leaving was a kind of, as he calls it, revolt and even cowardice in which he left. But finally, if you move on to number 7, he says that the real desire in his heart, the real reason for leaving, was that he wanted to experience what at that time he thought was only possible in solitude, to become, as he puts it, a real unspotted mirror of God and a mirror of divine things. And therefore, being, as it were, above the earth, having forsaken the earth, stationed on high by the Spirit of God. This was his goal. This was his desire. And, of course, he was afraid that this he would not be able to do in the context of responsibility for ongoing pastoral ministry. But if you drop down to number 9, he says the real problem if I'm honest with you, a much more serious question is, I did not think myself qualified to rule a flock or a herd, that is to say, to have authority over the souls of human beings. And in the case of human beings, hard as it is for one to learn how to submit to a rule, it seems far harder, he says, to know how to rule over others, and hardest of all, with this rule of ours, which leads them by the divine life and to God. So he was concerned about his own incapacity, and so he says that's what part of what prompted his flight. And he mentions in number 13, we should not undertake the care of others if we are ourselves still subject to really destructive weaknesses. And so the challenge is that you have to be, as he puts it in number 14, eminent in good. You should know no limits in goodness or spiritual progress. You should dwell upon the loss of what is still beyond them rather than the gain of what you have attained. Anyone who is going to guide or shepherd others has to be involved in an ongoing process of spiritual growth themselves. There is no having arrived until one arrives in God in the eschaton. So there is always a movement forward. And good friend's brother, Basil's brother, Gregory of Nyssa, will say that even that is not a static state, that even when we arrive in God, we are in a process of growing and developing and constantly growing nearer to God and expanding and becoming more like God, and that process goes on forever. So there is a willingness to say, I have never arrived, I am always in process, that is key for Gregory Nazianzen to the practice of offering spiritual help, spiritual advice to others. Then in number 15, the principle that I've highlighted in that dark bar, be sensitive and responsive to differences. You cannot suppose that the same things are suitable for everyone. And then in number 16, a beautiful phrase that I've highlighted in a light background, and this is quoted again and again throughout the centuries, the guiding of human beings, taking on responsibility for spiritual guidance, whether as a cleric or as a layperson. He says, it's the most variable and the most manifold of creatures. Human beings are the most changeable of beings. Therefore, this guiding, this art of leading or of offering spiritual advice to others is, he says, the art of arts, the techne technon, the art of all arts. In other words, the highest of arts, it is the science of science. So the episteme epistemon. It is the highest form of applied or acquired or then used knowledge, wisdom that can be possible for human beings. And he will go on, as we'll see, to compare this with the medical art of caring for bodies, that one is caring for the soul in the same way that the physician is caring for the body. And in many ways, he will claim this task of spiritual guidance, what we would call spiritual direction, is in many ways even more difficult. And then he says in 17, if you compare it with what is done with the body, this concern is with the soul, which comes from God and is divine. You are concerning yourself with something that is not ordinary, but bears the characteristic of God. And he then goes on to say, towards the end of number 17, that the goal is that the soul can draw to itself and raise to heaven the lower nature. There is a consecration of the body that occurs through spiritual guidance. The soul becomes for the body what, he says, God is for us. And that will be the goal of the spiritual guide, of the spiritual director. If we drop down to number 21, he says, our office as physicians of souls, and he's speaking primarily as a cleric, primarily from the context of clerical spiritual direction, but this can also be generalized to anyone who's involved in this ministry. It far exceeds, he says, in toilsomeness and consequently in worth that which is confined to the body. And intriguingly, he then says, because the latter, the care of a physical physician, is with what he calls the surface, and to some extent, but only to a slight extent, investigates the deeper causes, by which he means the spiritual causes that are deeply hidden. He says, to do this, in the next highlighted text, we are in need of great faith, perfect faith, and of still greater cooperation on the part of God. It's not just our doing, it's God who does it. And he says, countermaneuvering on our own part, being aware of how human beings act and being ready for that so that the word, the challenge from God can be offered. The ends in view, he says, of each of these forms of healing in number 22, and I've indicated in this dark bar that the end will be theosis, divinization. He says the scope of our art towards the end of 22 is to provide the soul with wings. This is an image taken from Plato's Phaedrus, the idea that the soul, as it grows, expands and moves towards God with, as it were, spiritual wings. And he says, in short then, theon poi eisai, to deify, to make like God the soul and to bestow heavenly bliss upon it. Now, he is not in any sense neglecting the theology of grace. It's God who does this, but the one who offers spiritual guidance is serving as cooperator, one might even say instrument of God, in this process of bestowing bliss, of enabling the other to experience this deification. So the ultimate goal of the soul is the same goal as that of the spiritual guide, the spiritual director. He gives an example in 24 of all biblical salvation history is for our healing. When we read the scriptures, when we consider what Christ has done, when we consider what God has done during the whole course of history, in number 24 he says, this is the reason that the soul might be deified, that the soul might be rendered like God. This is the reason for the generation of humanity and of Christ himself, for the Virgin, the manger, in Bethlehem, the generation, the coming into birth on behalf of creation of the Lord. In 25, this is why the heathen rage and the peoples imagine vain things. At the end of number 25, all of these, meaning all of these biblical stories, all of these biblical models, the whole of our appropriation and appreciation of salvation history, he says, and in this highlighted text at the end of 25, are a training from God for us, a healing for our weakness, restoring the old Adam to the place whence he fell, conducting us to the tree of life. This beautiful image that we've seen of the descent into hell, into the deepest part of the self, where Christ raises up that which is fallen and broken and diseased and makes it like himself, heals it. Then in number 26, we, he says, are the fellow laborers, the ministers of this healing, this therapeia. And he says it is a much greater thing to have this power to heal and skillfully cleanse those of others. It's a very difficult project. He quotes, interestingly here, Hippocrates in number 27. The healers of bodies will have their labors and vigils and cares of which we are aware, and will reap a harvest of pain for themselves from the distresses of others. This is from Hippocrates' treatise on natures. And clearly this reflects something of Gregory Nazianzen's classical background, but his willingness to draw comparisons with the physician's healing art and the art of the person who is engaged in the direction of, in the guidance of souls. Number 28, this is the core of this section of this oration, and I've only quoted a portion of it. It's a very long text of which I've extracted the centralmost portion that corresponds to or is concerned with the issue of spiritual guidance. Here he points out different diseases require different remedies. We cannot simply say the same thing, recommend exactly the same practice to everyone. We require great skill to treat, to have people, to get others treated properly, to get them to change their lives. And he says, how great is the distinction in number 29 between all the people we will see, the married and the unmarried, between hermits and those who live in community, between those who are proficient and those who are advanced in contemplation, but between those who are barely able to keep from sinning, between townsfolk and ordinary people, between simple people and those who have all sorts of Machiavellian plans, between men of business and men of leisure. These are all distinct kinds of individuals, and what we recommend must be based on their situation. We have to be aware of the distinctions, the differences, the states of life, all of this comes to play in terms of what the person who is going to offer advice to others recommends. It's not always the same thing. Ultimately, of course, it's the gospel of Christ. It's the good news that one is sharing, but it has to be shared in a way that can be heard by the individual, which means being aware of all these distinctions among human beings. He concludes in number 29, to be aware of all of this, to regulate all of this, the mixtures and blendings of the elements of which we are composed. We would say today the various physiological distinctions, the various temperament differences, the various psychological types, the various kinds of psychopathology and personality types. That's effectively what he's saying here. It is no easy task, but an absolutely essential one if one is to engage in the process of guiding others' souls. So souls, he says in number 30, are treated with varying instruction and with guidance. And he points out in 31, some are benefited by praise, others by blame. In 32, on some it is needful to keep a close watch, and others, it's best to not give them the impression that one's taking any notice. It depends on the individual and how they respond to that kind of oversight. And in number 33, he's using the principle, adapt the remedy to the illness, as I put in the dark bar. Our treatment is not the same as simply defining virtue and vice, virtue being good, a balance, and vice being destructive, always. Instead, we may discover, he says in the highlighted text, that our medicines do not invariably provide turn out to be either most wholesome or most dangerous. In some cases, what we recommend is good and useful, but in others, it has the contrary effect. And we can't simply dismiss people because they didn't listen to us or they didn't take our advice. Effectively, what Gregory is saying is that it is our responsibility to learn what the other can hear and to adapt what we say to them. Otherwise, they will not be hearing the deeper message we're trying to convey. We cannot satisfy ourselves that, well, I recommended this and I always recommend this to everybody and I know that it works. That is being a bad guide of souls, as far as Gregory Nazianzen is concerned. We have to be aware of distinctions among people. And as we'll see, this is taken up again and again in the spiritual literature. He says, their safety, and this is a kind of a concluding passage, the safety or balance that people are able to achieve as a result of being successfully guided spiritually depends upon maintaining a kind of balance. And again, the model here is the model that is used to define virtue. Now, in number 35, I've included one section of the portion where he goes on to describe a more specifically pastoral, priestly, and episcopal task, and that's the task of preaching. But because the spiritual guide often recommends scripture, is often borrowing from scripture, I thought I would include this little text as well, again, a very classical phrase that recurs again and again in the tradition. To me, to Gregory, he says, indeed it seems no slight task and one requiring no little spiritual power to give in due season to each their portion of the word. Katakairon hekasto tulogu. To give to each one the kind of word of God, the experience of God, the word that is necessary for them in their kairos, in their season. Kairos is not the same thing as simply time. It implies a time that is conditioned by the specific circumstances of the time of year, whether a thing is appropriate or fitting, whether something is likely to be attaining its proper end. The kairos is the fitting time, the proper time in which a thing can be done well. So the word needs to be applied with, he says, a great sensitivity, a great delicacy, a great awareness of the uniqueness and specific quality of the other. Effectively, Gregory is providing us with a contemplative task. One must be able to behold the other as a unique expression, manifestation of God. One must be able to contemplate God in the other and see how all require the same word of consolation, but each must hear it in the way that is specific for the constitution which God has given them. And to be a good spiritual guide, to be a good spiritual leader, means to be sensitive to that and to regard it and to take it into consideration when one, as he puts it, gives them that word in due season.